From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine defiant amid further Russian threats to its sovereignty. Arab Summit aims to bridge some regional divides. Tensions between locals and Sudanese refugees in South Sudan boiling over. Plus, it is World TB Day. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian protesters gathered in Kiev's Independence Square on Sunday, calling for unity a day after Russian forces seized the last major Ukrainian military base in Crimea. And in the eastern city of Donetsk, pro-Russian protesters gathered around an administration building, calling for the resignation of the local governor who is loyal to Kiev. Warnings from various quarters, including Ukraine's interim government, NATO's top military commander, and the chairman of the U.S. House Intelligence Committee, that Russian forces are poised to go beyond Crimea, are prompting calls for a more robust response from Washington and other Western capitals. VOA's Steve Herman reporting now from Kiev.
Members of a bipartisan U.S. congressional delegation visiting Kiev say they have been told by all the Ukrainians they met that they will not yield another inch of territory to Russia and that the Ukrainians are ready to fight. The two senators and one representative told reporters they are optimistic that tougher sanctions, other punitive legislation under consideration by their colleagues, and a united front by Western European countries can deter Russia from further provocations. Congressman Stephen Lynch is a Massachusetts Democrat and a member of the National Security Subcommittee.
They've won the Battle of Crimea for now, and they may be anticipating going into eastern Ukraine tomorrow. But this won't be a short battle. This will be something long-term, and we're sure that our neighbors in NATO and democratic-loving nations will stand together in the long run.
All major Ukrainian military bases on the Crimean Peninsula, annexed last week by Moscow, are now under the control of Russian forces. Other Russian troops are conducting drills at Ukraine's eastern gate, and Crimea's self-declared premier has issued a call for Russians across the ex-Soviet country to rise up against Kiev's rule, which Moscow regards as illegitimate. Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, a Republican and member of the Armed Services Committee, said the United States already has done some muscle flexing and indicated it and NATO would do more should there be an invasion of the Ukrainian mainland.
We have already had the USS Truxton doing exercises. We've already moved F-16s, to have exercises in the area. We have the ability with NATO forces certainly to move force posture in the area. We're not looking for a conflict, a military conflict, obviously, with Russia.
But if there is war between Russia and Ukraine, says U.S. Senator Joe Donnelly, a Democrat from the state of Indiana, the responsibility will squarely fall on the shoulders of President Vladimir Putin in Moscow.
This will not be Crimea. There will be horrific loss of life. There will be young Russian men who will be killed in this effort. And he will have to look their moms and dads in the eyes and explain to them why their son was lost or their daughter was lost in the invasion of another country.
The tension between the neighboring countries with a long mutual history and shared Russian heritage is splitting friends and family. Legal Secretary Zhenia Kuzmenko is the daughter of a Russian father and a Ukrainian mother.
I'm very concerned because my parents live like 70 kilometers from Russian border, and I'm not happy to wake up one day in different countries with them. And we want to be independent. We are not happy to be with Russia.
Russian defense officials are quoted by state-run media as saying Moscow is complying with international agreements, limiting the number of its troops near the border with Ukraine. But Germany's foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, said after visiting Ukraine, he fears Russia may have opened Pandora's box, attempting to redraw national borders in Europe. Steve Herman, VOA News, Kiev.
President Obama arrives in Europe later today for G7 and EU meetings, expected to be overshadowed by Russia's annexation of Crimea and the threat of further Russian incursions into Ukraine. VOA's Michael Bowman has our report.
As Russia tightens its grip on Crimea and continues to deploy and position its military might, the United States and the European Union hope to forestall any new Russian advances.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military in a way that could lead to further incursions into southern and eastern Ukraine. For this reason, we've been working closely with our European partners to develop more severe actions that could be taken if Russia continues to escalate the situation.
The administration is leaving no doubt as to the focus of this week's consultations. National Security Advisor Susan Rice.
These meetings obviously take place against the backdrop of Russia's intervention in Ukraine. What will be clear for the entire world to see is that Russia is increasingly isolated.
With an overwhelming Russian force massed along its eastern borders, Ukraine is bracing for further incursions. Acting Foreign Minister Andrei Deshutsa.
We are ready to respond. And as you know, Ukrainian government is trying to use all the peaceful means and diplomatic means to stop Russians. At this moment, when Russian troops would be invading Ukraine from the east, would be for us difficult to ask people who live in them there, Ukrainians who live in there, not to respond on this military invasion.
Last week, the United States tightened sanctions against Russia. Moscow responded with travel bans on high-ranking U.S. officials and lawmakers, including Senator John McCain, who is urging a boost in U.S. assistance to Kyiv.
I see nothing wrong with providing both lethal and non-lethal assistance to the government of Ukraine, which has just had its nation invaded and dismembered.
The crisis in Ukraine is sure to be a focal point of deliberations on Capitol Hill when lawmakers return from a week-long recess Monday. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Check out our website for the latest on what's happening in Ukraine and Crimea, plus international reaction. We're at voanews.com.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
France provided new satellite data on Sunday showing possible debris from the missing Malaysia Airlines jet as searchers combing a remote part of the southern Indian Ocean tried without success to locate a pallet that could be a key clue in solving one of the world's biggest aviation mysteries.
Aujourd'hui, nous avons transmis aux autorités malaisiennes des informations relatives à des éco-radars. Il ne s'agit pas d'images, mais d'éco-radars.
French Foreign Ministry spokesperson Romain Nadal said they are not images, but radar echoes by a French satellite, which identified debris that could be from the Malaysia Airlines plane inside a zone in the Indian Ocean that's located about 2,300 kilometers from Perth, Australia. Malaysia Air Flight 370, which was on its way from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, went missing over the Gulf of Thailand on March 8th with 239 people aboard. Turkey has shot down a Syrian warplane during pitched fighting between Syrian rebels and government troops near the border. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the Syrian plane violated Turkish airspace. Syrian state TV says the plane was pursuing rebels in Syrian territory. Syrian rebels and government forces have been fighting for control of the Kassab border crossing in Syria's Latakia province for 3 days. Foreign ministers from across the Arab world will hold the 25th Arab League summit. It begins tomorrow in Kuwait. Philip Walter Wellman is following the story.
Organizers say the Arab League summit comes at a critical time in the region, and collaboration among member states is needed to move forward. One of the most pressing issues is Syria's civil war, which has claimed around 150,000 lives, according to some estimates, and continues to fuel sectarian tensions in neighboring states. But after 3 years of fighting and futile attempts to restore peace, Rice University research fellow Christian Koltz Ulrichsen says it's unlikely the League will be able to coordinate a truce.
I think there's a feeling that, as in Libya, the Arab League was the kind of natural place to start. But I think with the Arab countries themselves divided over whom to support and what extent, that has also made it much more difficult to try and come up with a coherent position on Syria.
Kuwait is holding the League's annual summit for the first time since becoming a member in 1961. It says bridging regional divides is one of its main aims as host. The meeting is being held under the slogan Solidarity for a Better Future. Now, before the talks, Kuwait's Foreign Affairs Minister, Sheikh Sabah al-Khaled al-Sabah, said Arab solidarity was already strengthening in many domains. The director of research and consultancy at the Dubai-based Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis, Theodore Karasik, says the minister's claim is an overstatement.
The title for this year's conference is one that is completely contradictory to what's ongoing in the region. And I highly doubt that the Arab League is going to be able to put forward a final closing statement that says that the Arab League is unified, given so many divisions within the member states.
Further division came to light earlier this month when Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain withdrew their ambassadors from Qatar, accusing their Gulf neighbor, which has backed the Muslim Brotherhood, of jeopardizing regional security.
I'm curious, and I think a lot of other people will be curious about if the issue of Qatar and this dispute between Doha and Riyadh and Cairo and the Emirates comes to the forefront of the Arab League meeting. And I think that will be quite telling of the impact of this squabble within the region.
Analysts like Karasik say divisions among the Gulf states could affect the capability of the Arab League because of the financial flows supporting the organization. The Arab League was founded in 1945 to strengthen relations among member states and promote the interests of Arabs. 13 heads of state have confirmed their attendance for this year's summit. Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
Iraqi journalists are calling for the execution of a presidential guard accused of killing the Baghdad bureau chief of Radio Free Iraq. That's an arm of the U.S. government's international broadcast operations. He was killed Saturday at the gate to the Iraqi presidential compound after the two argued over whose vehicle should pass through the checkpoint first. The guard was working for Iraqi President Jalal Talabani at a checkpoint near his residence. A North Korean-flagged oil tanker that a Libyan militia illegally loaded with crude oil has returned to Libya. U.S. forces seized that vessel last week off the Mediterranean island of Cyprus, stopping an attempt by Libyan rebels to sell the crude oil in defiance of the government in Tripoli. Rebel forces in eastern Libya had loaded an estimated 234,000 barrels of oil onto the tanker, worth around $24 million. The return of the tanker is a rare victory for Tripoli, which is struggling to end a port blockage by rebels, one of many challenges facing the central government that's failed to secure the North African country 3 years after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi. North Korea, by the way, has denied responsibility for that tanker. Algeria's three-week presidential campaign kicked off on Sunday with the incumbent president and his chief rival both promising to make the country more democratic by amending the constitution. President Abdelaziz Bouteflika is running for his fourth five-year term and will be largely sitting out of the campaign and relying on deputies to present his case. After a stroke last year left the 77-year-old in a wheelchair and with trouble speaking. His chief rival, former Prime Minister Ali Benflie, proposes a new system where the parliament would have real power with an independent justice system. There's been scattered protests against a fourth term for Mr. Bouteflika, most quickly crushed by security forces.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Ugandan police are saying at least 19 people, most of them children, have died in a boat accident. Happened on Lake Albert, which lies along the Ugandan-Congo border. Police say the boat was carrying 96 Congolese refugees when it capsized Saturday. At least 45 were rescued, and a search for continuing for 32 missing men, women, and children. Gunmen entered a church service in coastal Kenya on Sunday and opened fire on worshipers, killing at least four people and wounding several others. Witnesses said blood-spattered Bibles and overturned chairs lay strewn across the church floor after the attack near the port city of Mombasa. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali Islamist group Al-Shabaab and its Kenyan sympathizers have been blamed for similar attacks. UN Refugee Agency reports tensions between local residents and Sudanese refugees in Mabon County in South Sudan's Upper Nile State are boiling over. The UNHCR says many people are fleeing their camps to other countries in fear. Lisa Schlein reports from the UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports recent reciprocal attacks between South Sudanese residents of Mabon in Upper Nile State and Sudanese refugees have forced up to 8,000 refugees to flee from the Yusuf Batil camp. UNHCR spokeswoman Fatoumata Lejeune Kaba says the refugees since have returned to the camp, but tensions persist and have spread to the Doro and Kaya refugee camps. She says the villagers and refugees are fighting over limited resources, including wood, grass, and grazing land. She says the hostility between the two groups reached such a fever pitch recently that both groups set fire to each other's houses, tents, and granaries. She tells VOA the villagers themselves are suffering as much as the refugees.
They're not in any better shape than the refugees, and this is all due to the current situation. Mabon is an isolated area with the fighting since December. It's been one of the hardest hit areas, and people can't just, whether it's humanitarian agencies or commercially, people can't just go in and out of the town. Just the day before yesterday, when I was reading the reports, when I was talking with my colleagues on the ground, Mabon was under the control of rebels. This morning, it was taken over by the government. So there's a lot of fighting going on.
Mabon County hosts 125,000 Sudanese refugees who fled from embattled Blue Nile State. The UNHCR says one-third of the refugee population is made up of small children, pregnant and lactating women, as well as the elderly, disabled, and people who are chronically ill. Fighting between government and rebel forces broke out in South Sudan in mid-December. Since then, instability and conflict in Mabon County have disrupted the planting and harvest seasons. In addition, aid agencies are having great difficulty transporting food and other supplies to the region because of insecurity along the roads. Lejeune Kaba says local residents are very angry over the growing food shortages. She says they are demanding that some 60,000 refugees in Yusuf Batil and Gendrasa camps leave within 2 months.
Realistically, we can't do it. The rainy season is coming. 60,000 people is a lot, and this Mabon is an area where you can't move people fast. You need trucks, and we don't even want to get to that situation where people would have to be moved to, because it takes a lot to identify a site. The land on the sites we've identified belong to people. You have to negotiate with them for them to agree to take them in. And if they learn that there's been fighting, I don't think they would want to welcome refugees.
Lejeune Kaba says the UNHCR is working with authorities and other humanitarian agencies to diffuse the tensions. Mabon County is close to Ethiopia. She says the governments of South Sudan and Ethiopia have agreed to let the World Food Program bring much-needed food supplies into Mabon through Gambela in Ethiopia. She says the food, which will be distributed to internally displaced people and refugees in the coming days, should help reduce some of the tensions between the refugees and Syrian locals. Meanwhile, she notes insecurity and hunger are forcing more South Sudanese to flee into neighboring countries. She says Ethiopia currently is receiving an average of 1,000 South Sudanese refugees every day. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
Well, it turns out that there is some good news and some sobering news to report today, World TB Day. The good news is that there are new drugs, new tests, and a promising vaccine being developed. The bad news, drug resistance is common, and a multi-drug resistant variety of TB is being called a global threat. VOA's Carol Pearson has our report.
Tuberculosis is an old disease that remains a global problem. Even though the World Health Organization reports the death rate has dropped to nearly half of what it was 20 years ago, Dr. Anthony Fauci heads the Infectious Diseases Division at the U.S. National Institutes of Health.
1/3 of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis latently. They're not sick, but they potentially could get sick because they have tuberculosis in them.
Most of those infected with TB live in developing countries, and people with HIV have a high risk of developing TB.
Each year, there are over 8 million new infections with tuberculosis whereby people become ill.
1,300,000 people died from TB last year. The medical aid group, Doctors Without Borders, warns that drug-resistant TB has become a global threat. Tuberculosis is caused by bacteria. It's spread by cough. In Chicago, Dr. Dean Schroffnagel treats about 200 TB patients a year. He spoke to VOA by Skype.
Treatment is prevention because once you treat a single case, then that person is no longer able to spread it to anyone else.
The problem is the billions who don't know they have TB are not in treatment or stop taking their medicine. But despite this, both doctors say there's good news. First, Dr. Fauci.
Over the last 10 or so years, the number of cases and the number of deaths from tuberculosis has come down, mostly through public health measures.
We can't let up. We can't say, okay, we've made some progress. We don't need to do more.
That's because it's clear that if TB is not controlled early and drug-resistant strains spread, the world will face a much deadlier threat. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And as the world observes World TB Day, South Africa is struggling to conquer its top killer. With 80% of the country's young adults already infected with tuberculosis, health experts say there is no time to lose. World Health Organization says 482,000 of South Africa's 50 million people contract TB every year, and it is the leading cause of death. Of the more than 505,000 people who died in South Africa in 2011, 12% of the men and 10% of the women died from TB. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It was good to have you here. You know, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On March 24th, 1707, the Acts of Union was signed, officially uniting the kingdoms of England and Scotland and creating Great Britain. In 1832, a Hiram, Ohio mob tarred and feathered Mormon leader Joseph Smith. Smith survived the attack. The reason for the violence is disputed, but many believe it was due to controversies surrounding a romance that Smith had with a local woman. Magician Eric Weiss was born on this day in 1874. At an early age, he showed skills as an acrobat and contortionist, and later became the greatest escape artist the world had ever known. Weiss is better known by his stage name, Harry Houdini. There were several broadcasting firsts on this date. In 1896, Russian Alexander Popov became one of the first people to transmit a message by radio waves. Unknown to Popov, Italian Guglielmo Marconi had done the same thing a year earlier using another method. In 1930, an experimental station in New York City aired the first televised church service. In 1934, the United States Congress passed the Tidings-McDuffie Act, mapping out a process by which the Philippines would become an independent nation. In 1958, rock and roll pioneer Elvis Presley was inducted into the U.S. Army. On this day in 1976, the president of Argentina, Isabel Perón, was deposed by the country's military in a bloodless coup. 5 years later, she was exiled to Spain. In 1998, two boys ages 11 and 13 opened fire on teachers and students at Westside Middle School in Jonesboro, Arkansas. 5 people were killed and 10 wounded. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned over the shrinking space for civil society around the world. In a statement to the 25th session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, Paula Schrieffer, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs and Head of Delegation, said that progress depends on the ability of individuals to coalesce around shared goals and harness the power of their convictions. History and current events demonstrate that nations that respect the rights of all their populations are more just, prosperous, and secure. But, Ms. Schrieffer noted, every day journalists and human rights activists report how representatives of civil society are beaten, tortured, and sometimes murdered for expressing opinions and assembling peacefully together. And, she said, restrictions on the rights of freedom of expression and of peaceful assembly and association are instrumental in leading to violence and abuse. Deputy Assistant Secretary Schrieffer cited several areas of concern. In Venezuela, she said, the government is suppressing what began as peaceful demonstrations by students upset with high levels of crime. In efforts to quell the spreading nationwide protests, the government sent troops to use live ammunition against the people, shut down foreign media, the internet and social media, and arrested an opposition political leader and protesters without due process. Ms. Schrieffer said these actions contradict the government's commitment to respect the rights of freedom of assembly and expression. She urged that trusted third parties facilitate the conversation as Venezuelans search for solutions to end the violence and deal with political division in a democratic fashion. In other parts of the world, restrictive laws are hindering civil society's ability to operate. Ms. Schrieffer pointed to Egypt, where the law limits organizations' operations and their ability to receive foreign funding, to Uzbekistan, where a December decree, supposedly aimed at simplifying registration procedures, resulted in NGOs becoming subject to onerous tax inspections and extensive requirements for governmental approval, to Nigeria, where a recent law criminalizes attending or organizing meetings related to LGBT persons. In addition, many countries, Ms. Schrieffer noted, are enacting restrictive internet regulations and have increased detentions and lengthy prison terms for bloggers. This is a critical moment, Deputy Assistant Secretary Schrieffer said to the Council, for member states to redouble our efforts to stand with civil society in the promotion and protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms and the pursuit of democratic progress.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.